It's your time to Ed Up with America's leading higher education podcast network, the Ed Up Experience, where we make education your business. This is Ed Up Legal with your host, Patty Roberts. She's Dean at St. Mary's School of Law, and she's going to be leading conversations about legal education in today's world. Now let's hear from your host, Patty Roberts.
Welcome to Ed Up Legal. I'm Patty Roberts at St. Mary's University School of Law, and today we're talking with Charles H. Rose III. He is the Dean and Professor of Law of Ohio Northern University, Pettit College of Law, a position he's held since 2019. Welcome, Dean Rose.
Oh, Patty, please call me Charlie. The Charles H. Rose III is the sum total of my inheritance from my daddy in Alabama. So I appreciate it when people put it out there. So, you know, I got a Roman numeral, and so I like to display it proudly, but all my friends call me Charlie, so please call me Charlie.
All right. Well, that's great. So you started as dean at Ohio Northern in 2019, and as all our listeners will know, a big thing happened that spring. So how was your transition to being a dean when the end of the first year you were faced with a global pandemic?
Well, it was for me a really interesting experience because I analogized it to my time in the military. I know how to crisis plan. I know how to backwards plan. I know how to set small-term goals and keep people safe, to, you know, to orient on the mission first, your people second, and then yourself third. And looking back on it now, I kind of went into that sort of mode for the first 6 months. And I sort of taught people to think that way. And my staff was really responsive. So we could be nimble and do what we needed to do. And I went into it with the idea, one overarching thing was that I'm not going to lose anybody while we're going through this. I'm not going to lose a faculty member. I'm not going to lose a staff member. I'm not going to lose a student. We'll give the best education that we can, but we are going to keep people safe. And that, you know, knock on wood to date, is absolutely the case. My university is the staff and faculty in the law school are over 90% vaccinated. We're a encouraged but not demand school. And my law school population is sitting about 83% vaccinated. So we have, we're in a pretty good spot, but we're still wearing masks in class and we're still, you know, weekly COVID testing for people who aren't vaccinated and all those things. It's like a movement to contact against an enemy that you can't see. And it's been one of my faculty members said, well, we had the right dean at the right time for this mess. That's been interesting. The most important thing I think you need to have during this time, though, is empathy and kindness for everybody, because everyone's stressed and you have to just sort of metaphorically put your arms around folks and be understanding without being smothering. And that's a talent that not everybody in higher education has. You know, we tend to be hard charging people and we're not always good about taking the time to slow down and just listen.
Well, it certainly does sound like they have the right dean at the right time. You were in the Army for 20 years, active duty and a judge advocate general. Before you joined legal education, and I understand you started at Stetson University.
Yes, I did. I spent about 15 years there, 14 and a half years. It was a wonderful time. I got to do some really interesting things with simulated experiential learning and learning by doing, which is sort of my thing. You know, we all have a thing, right? And my thing is that magic that happens in the moment of presentation. And Stetson was a wonderful place to do that. It was very supportive and very, at the time, Darby Dickerson was the dean there. She went on to be the dean at Texas Tech and then UIC. And she was recent president of AALS, and Darby really supported that sort of forward-looking mentality. And it's kind of the thing that I do when it comes to legal education.
Well, I know that they were ranked number one for 12 consecutive years in their trial advocacy program. And is that where you got your nickname, the Godfather of Advocacy?
Yeah, it is. They call me the Godfather of Advocacy, and they used to call me the Dean of Advocacy, although once I became a dean, that title kind of went away. All I really did, Patty, was bring people together and talk about trial team competitions at an academic level and just make the argument to folks that we should be focusing on the educational value that exists in these competitions, the formation of professional identity, the teaching of ethics in conjunction with the skill, and the value that that creates is transformational for the student, because it's where everything comes together and they actually understand all that stuff they learned in the first year of law school, all the procedural stuff that they learned in the second year, the ethics, and they go, oh my God, this is why this matters. And that happens at moot court, it happens at trial, it happens at dispute resolution. There's no other place in law school where you can control as many factors as you can in the simulated side. I also oversaw our clinics and externships at Stetson for about 3 or 4 years. And so I got to compare the two, and they're similar, but very different, because in the simulated world, I can control every variable. In the real world, I can't control judges. I can't control opposing counsel. I can't control clients. And so I can set it up to teach a particular thing. And that's really neat. It's some of the best learning that happens, but it is labor intensive. And it is not for the faint of heart.
That is absolutely true. As you know, we have a fantastic trial director of advocacy, A.J. Belita DeLuna, who's now an assistant dean of advocacy.
And I heard about that.
Yeah, he's doing extraordinary work here. We are so fortunate to have him. But I know that he's done a lot of work with you, too. And so
I have worked with A.J. I have known A.J. since he came to a conference that I put on at Stetson well over a decade ago. And I remember him when he was just a coach. He had this burning desire to do and be more. And AJ's the kind of person that the more you give him, the more he does. His bandwidth is extremely high. His students are fiercely loyal to him. There's no quit in his motor, and he gets it. And he can also teach, which not all coaches can teach, but AJ can teach. And that's it's a unique combination. He's done great work for you guys at St. Mary's, and he will continue to do great work for you if you can hang on to him.
Yeah, that's the $64,000 question. Well, actually, more than that.
In higher education, that's always the question, right? The good talent can go elsewhere. You have to feed their needs while also balancing all of your financial concerns as an institution. People don't understand the levers and the wheels that move behind the office of the dean, or they don't know.
That's right.
If they did, they probably wouldn't sleep at night.
But we have to let them think that we are like the Wizard of Oz, right behind the curtain.
Oh, Wizard of Oz! I'm a duck floating in the middle of the water, and meanwhile, you know, I've got 1,000 things going on all at the same time, and half of them might work out, half of them might not, and they're all in different levels. It's, you know, if you have ADD, it's a great job because there's always something new to deal with, right?
Yes. And you have some really cool new things going on at Ohio Northern. I want to first talk about the attention that you're paying to advocacy programs there. You're about to embark on a big expansion or having a big expansion right now.
Yeah, I have always believed that that for competition teams to truly have value educationally, they have to be a class. It's got to be part of your curriculum. It's got to have a syllabus. It's not a club. And my faculty just approved 2 courses, Advanced Appellate Advocacy and Advanced Trial Advocacy. And so now all of the students who are in those, who are on those teams are being taught fundamental skills in those classes every week. Interim director of advocacy, Dave Rack, a contracts professor, by the way, is teaching appellate advocacy. Yep. And I, the dean of the law school, teach the trial advocacy class.
In the classroom doing trial advocacy.
Oh, absolutely. Advocacy. I have taught almost every semester that I have been here, except for the first. because I felt like John Sexton, who was at NYU for all those years, always taught as a dean and always taught as a president. And I listened to him give a speech once where he talked about the value of that connection to the classroom as an administrator, that you it keeps you grounded in what's important, and it helps you understand what your faculty are going through. And it is an affirmation that you actually believe the thing that you're talking about because you're still doing it. And I've always been a walk the walk kind of person. And I live for the days that I'm in class. I was just in class yesterday, and it was the best day of the week, because for just those few moments, I was just focused on teaching somebody something and watching them grow, that transformation that happens on the micro scale that you get to see on the macro scale as the dean, but you don't always get to see in the classroom. That, and man, that moment for me, it's energizing because it means that the world is moving in the right direction. And maybe I might be doing something right because this moment happened for this student today. And so I stay in the classroom. You'll pry it out of my cold, dead hands, I would imagine.
Well, so you've just, the faculty's just passed these two classes. And are there other plans moving forward with the advocacy programs?
Yeah, there's a thing that you and I had to move this for a week for scheduling purposes. And it was actually very helpful to me because I just got back from Iceland and Oxford. I was in Iceland talking to University of Iceland. We've had a 60-year relationship with them that started with a guy named Dean Hansen at ONU who went to Iceland on a Fulbright scholarship. And for 60 years, we have had a student exchange program with the University of Iceland. Well, now we're going to go to Iceland and teach advanced comparative advocacy in a summer program. I've sent the stuff off to the ABA. It's going to be a 3-credit class, and we'll focus on storytelling, case analysis, those critical reasoning skills that are at the heart of what lawyers do, and some presentation skills. And we're going to have Icelandic students and American students together in the same classroom. And they're going to get to learn from each other, participate with each other. And we'll have professors from all across the nation who will come with their law students to be part of this. We sort of do it in a collaborative fashion. And we build it out with small group instructors so that they'll never have more than 6 or 8 kids in the small group sessions. We're really excited about it. It's part of our commitment to be on the cutting edge of advocacy instruction. And it's also a pretty safe and interesting place for the Instagram nation. Folks like to take pictures in Iceland.
It's beautiful, right?
It's beautiful. And it's remarkably safe in the time of COVID. Every person in the country is vaccinated. You can't get there without a vaccination certificate and a COVID test within 76 hours of flying, or 48 hours. And so there's just a beauty to it that we're really excited about. We just went over and inspected the facilities and have signed the agreement. And, here we go. That's a commitment, but it's also an opportunity. The thing that we try to do is to look for multiple opportunities to cross-reference the fundamental skills of lawyers with the work that lawyers do long-term. And that's one example of that. We also have practicums at ONU where, you take labor law and then you'll take the labor law practicum, which is a 1-hour class where you're practicing labor law under the advice of the lawyer professor who just taught you labor law, and you're doing it all in a real presentation time work. Those things work really well to make the law come alive for kids.
Yes, that sounds really interesting. Now, is that something that is across the board with your elective courses, or are there a handful that have a practicum? How do you determine which courses have a practicum?
Based upon the abilities and interests of the professor. So we have some that have practicums, some that don't. ONU is an interesting place in that it is, from its inception, and it's 136 years old now. It's the second oldest law school in the state of Ohio. It's a rural law school. It services, it creates the lawyers that exist in the counties between the coasts. you know, the young men and women who go out and become the county attorney, the prosecutor, the public defender, who make the wheels of government go. They become state representatives, U.S. House representatives, senators, governors. They're just salt of the earth folks who have to practically be able to practice law. And that has been our bailiwick, that's been our lane since our inception. But at the same time, you've had this tremendous commitment to the theory of the law that takes place in the first year. So I view it as a pyramid, almost like Bloom's taxonomy. The bottom pyramid is all that fundamental stuff that's learned in the first year. Then everything we do in the preceding, in the second year and the third year, relates back to those fundamental classes, so that you're turning it over and over again. And you don't get too esoteric, because everything relates back to something that you learned previously. That increases LSAT, that increases performance on the bar examination. It increases performance in clinics and externships and job offers, because my kids, quite frankly, punch above their weight. Most of them are first generation lawyers. A percentage of them have a low LSAT score, and we recruit those kids through our summer starter program on purpose. It's part of our mission to provide opportunity, but we don't let a single person in the law school that we don't think can pass the bar and get a job. And we make that promise to them coming in the door. And so all of that sort of built together in a tight little package. When I found it and saw it, I thought, why don't more people know about this law school? Because when I heard about it, I was like, are they still open? Yeah, when they asked me to apply for the dean's job, I said, well, I'll go talk to them, but I'm not moving to Ohio. There's no way I'm moving to Ohio. And I talked to them and I thought, these are good people and this is a great mission. And, you know, 3 months later, I was the dean. I was like, well, that was interesting. I've rarely worked with a group of people whose hearts are so pure and who keep their eye on the prize across the board. Everyone in the building cares and cares deeply. And everyone at the higher administration cares and cares deeply. And when a school is oriented like that, when it has that kind of leadership, you can do more with less than you would imagine. And when a school doesn't have that, it can't do anything.
It sounds like you and I are very similar institutions, a lot of heart, a lot of commitment to first generation students who might otherwise not be able to get into law school, and a commitment to their success. So I'm really excited to hear about that. And what you describe, that returning to the foundational courses, must be a significant part of your success on bar passage. I was going to ask you about that because you have such impressive bar stats.
Well, I think part of it is that structure. And the other piece of it is that we bring them in the door, assessing them for risk on the bar. And we track them into various programs depending upon how that works. So, for example, in the first year, they take a legal analysis class. We have a J term, which is in between this fall and the spring. And they're in the J term. They take a legal analysis class. We have a lab that's always attached to one of our doctrinal courses. This year, it happens to be attached to property, where they're doing bar type work as a lab in conjunction with the doctrinal course. We do the same thing with evidence in the second year, which is a required course here. I happen to teach the evidence class here at ONU. And it's fascinating to watch that work, because what's happening is they're learning the doctrine in conjunction with the way it has to be applied, not only when they practice, but when they take the bar examination. And the mentality is, we're going to train the way we fight. You know, we know that we've got to take this bar exam. We're not going to ignore it. We're not going to be a bar passage school, but we're going to deal with it. Much like a farmer would deal with needing to get the crops in. It's just a very practical approach. The other thing that we do is that when you come back at the start of your second year of law school, you take an assessment test to see how much you've retained from the first year. we identify on an individual basis where your strengths or weaknesses might be from a retention standpoint. Now, that doesn't affect your grade. It doesn't affect what classes you can take, but it will affect the way that we'll advise you on classes to take in the future and the things that we might steer you towards in a way that is exciting. We think we do it pretty well. AccessLex recently gave us a grant of $25,000. We've started a second year class that focuses on some fundamental aspects of doctrinal law, sort of as a refresher. And we're going to track those kids and see how they do in comparison to the kids who didn't have that class to see if we can maybe do even better. And it's been this way at ONU for a long, long time. There was a wonderful professor who, in the first year that I was a dean, she died of pancreatic cancer, and God rest her soul, a lady named Nancy Sable. And Nancy produced this. She was one of the first folks to truly think about bar passage systemically. She was a Jones Day lawyer, and she came to ONU to help kids pass the bar. And Nancy built some wonderful things, and so we're just paying forward what she did. And it's working pretty well.
That's who you just named your academic support suite after, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We, in fact, we're going to have a big ceremony this fall. We've got a poem that Nancy loved, and we've got a tree of life that's going to go up on the wall, and her name will be in the College of Law forever. You know, I'll walk by it every day when I go by the suite. And, you know, life is funny. Her last year before she got sick, she had 100% bar passage in the state of Ohio. Every wow. single ONU student who took the Ohio bar passed it. 100%.
Amazing.
And that was because Nancy knew every kid, and she talked to them, she checked on them, she lifted them up when they were having a hard time, and she kicked them in the butt when they needed a little bit of extra motivation. And those children responded to the love and support that she gave. And we're doing the same thing now. We're always looking for the modality of the individual contact on bar work, because we know statistically that the difference between passing and not passing is 180 minutes more than the other person did. You know, if you can do 3 hours more over the course of a week, and so we did 180 for Sable when she passed. It was a hashtag up here at ONU. And our kids in the middle of the pandemic with an online exam for the first time in history had an 86% bar passage in the state of Ohio. I mean, they rose to the occasion. And we're not perfect, but we pay attention to it. I think it's a moral duty. As an educator, I am a dean of a professional institution, and my job is to prepare you to practice the law. Part of being preparing you to practice the law is to prepare you to engage on the licensing exam. To do otherwise is to me not a moral position, and it is also kind of a bait and switch. Because you can run a law school another way and let kids in that you know are never going to pass and take their money because you just don't care. I can think of institutions that have done that. I won't name them. But I didn't want to be that kind of dean. I have to be able to look these kids in the eye and so that when I ask them to do something hard, they'll do it. And, you know, they know whether or not you care about them. And they will do anything in the world for you. You're going to get something in the mail here soon. It's the first edition of the Civil Rights Law Journal. When Black Lives Mattered here last year, it was a very tumultuous time. I have a African-American student who has a 3-4-year-old son. She's now a 3L. She just had her second child. And she came to me and she said, "Dean Rose, I am really bothered by this. I want to make a difference. And the way I want to make a difference is to provide voices for law students to talk about legal issues dealing with race that are important to them. Not what the professors say, not what, you know, the pundits say, but what we think is important." I said, "Well, okay, let's do it." And so we created this journal. We'd never had that type of journal here. And we were going to do it online, but by the time they got it written, I read it and I thought, well, this deserves more than that. So what we've done is we've turned this journal into a magazine so that there are visual representations of the story that's being told. Because you and I know that reading a law review article is not always the most exciting thing in the world.
There are no pictures.
This magazine has lots of pictures. So, you know, when they're talking about, the genocide of Uyghur women, there's photographs of those women. When they're talking about child labor, you know, there's little baby's feet on the side of the magazine, and it has transformed the experience of reading it. And we're really, really excited about it. And the lesson that I learned from that was not me. That was just me listening to a young woman who had an idea and empowering her to make it happen, you know, teaching her what it meant to write a law review article with students who maybe normally wouldn't be on law review, providing them with the support to make that happen, expanding the vision of what that type of thing is, getting other faculty to understand that we can have a journal and it doesn't have to look like every other journal that exists on the planet. It was a great journey and it was a great learning experience for me. And I was just grateful that she trusted me enough to come to me and say, "Hey, Dean, this is what my heart is telling me I need to do." And we have a great product as a result that sort of captures the spirit of the College of Law. And we're excited to share it. You know, those are the moments that make all the other stuff that we do as deans worthwhile, right?
Absolutely.
Those are cool.
I'm really looking forward to reading that. That sounds terrific. And she trusted you because she knew you could be trusted. I mean, that's very evident from our discussion that you have really presented yourself to your students as a resource and an empathetic leader, a servant leader, and it's very impressive.
Well, I learned that at Notre Dame.
Well,
you know.
Yes, yes.
I did.
Before we conclude, I wanted to ask you, as I've asked the other guests, what your predictions are for the future of legal education, how it's going to evolve over the next decade, and if it's a different answer, how it should evolve. We have how it's likely to evolve and then how it should evolve.
I think that, just take the top 20 law schools or top 30 law schools in the nation off the table. They're going to play the game that they've always played because it served them well. And they're going to want that game to stay that way. I think the rest of us are going to fragment and really serve our communities. Because if we don't serve our communities, we don't really have relevancy as small law schools. You know, being at ONU has taught me that you have to really be connected to the community that you serve if you want your law school to not only survive but thrive. And so I would predict that good leaders will understand that and will do what you've done. I mean, you've begun to really innovate and do some things that are not happening at other schools with your online JD, because that's what the community that you're servicing needs. You saw that and you built it. And I think that there's going to be an awful lot of just growth in really wild areas in that regard. And law school is not going to be one size fits all anymore. And I think that we will struggle with that. Some people will get it right and some people will get it wrong. But who will benefit from that is the student. And that's the way it should be. I do worry about critical reasoning skills of kids coming out of college because of COVID and because of the hyper focus on passing standardized tests to get your funding at the grade school and the high school level. And I worry that we may have to really shift our focus on teaching critical reasoning in law schools. And if I was building a new law school right now, I would want a piece of what we did. We would start with the question of, what skills do our law students need to have coming in the door? And then we would say, what skills are we actually seeing coming in the door? And how might we transform our curriculum to bridge that gap? So maybe a first semester of nothing more than critical reasoning and logical thought and identifying with specificity what issues are, cutting through to the to the core of issues might really empower a lot of students who haven't had an opportunity to learn that. And that might be an exciting curriculum to teach in at some point in time. So I think we're going to get fragmentation. We're going to get a lot of experimentation because folks will have to do it. You know, we're conservative, aren't we? We don't like change in higher education, but when our back's against the wall, we can be quite creative. COVID taught us that. And our backs are against the wall financially across the nation. That's just the way it is. I mean, if you're a dean or a university president, you are constantly dealing with the finances of the place. Now, nobody else thinks about that, and that's good because they're busy learning. But the truth of the matter is that the bills have to be paid and it has to be a viable enterprise. And so we've got to sort that out. And I think that's going to drive a lot of really interesting ideas, because that's the only way that you can survive it. You know, we can't build buggies anymore. We've got to build electric cars. And law schools, a lot of them are built to build buggies. And that's going to be turmoil. You and I are blessed to be deans in interesting times, which means that there's opportunity and there's threat. And I think there's going to be a lot of that. Probably I might see the end of it before I retire, but probably not. I think at least another 15 to 20 years of it, to be honest with you.
Well, it sounds like you and I have teams and student bodies and institutions that are enabling the building of electric cars. So we are fortunate in
that's
that
the hope. As long as they don't blow up, we'll be fine.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking with you, and I look forward to reading about your Iceland program. Very exciting.
Well, you'll be getting, well, if God is good, A.J. Bolito de Luna will be teaching in it, and some of your St. Mary's students will be there this summer, and you'll have pictures of them in the Blue Lagoon.
Okay, I'm looking forward to that.
it wouldn't hurt for you to come visit, too. You might enjoy it.
I've never been to Iceland. My husband was stationed there for a while when he was in the Navy. And so he doesn't share the same, oh, I'd love to go to Iceland that I do.
It is simultaneously the most beautiful and wildly desolate place that I've ever seen. It is like you were on another planet. It's the only place that I've been, and I spent 20 years in the Army, been all over this globe. It's the only place I've been where I felt removed from planet Earth. It is magical in that way. You could make an argument that it is another realm almost. And that's a great thing to see and experience. I don't know that I would move there.
Right.
But in the short term, wow.
It's fortunate really cool. Your students will be to have that experience, and the students who join you.
And the trick is to do it in a way that doesn't cost them an arm and a leg.
That's
the trick. All right. Well Patty, I've enjoyed it. Thank you for the time.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
This has been another episode of EdUp Legal with your host, Patty Roberts. EdUp Legal is part of the EdUp Experience podcast network, bringing you the brightest and most influential minds across higher education and beyond. Here at EdUp, we make education your business.